From Here to Obscurity, The Quiet Men of England, Number 2, Kingston, Bagpuys, in which we learn of the cohesive collaboration of village life and meet an official. Gird your loins, melt your guns. It is time once more to wend our weary way, as needs must and circumstance and deadline dictate, to that Stoke Poges on a budget, that august Riviera hamlet, that English settlement of dubious and questionable memory, to Wesley Turpin. Looming like a wanton floozy at a bar, when she's had too much and you not enough, the parish church of St. Matthias hung desperately above the Crick Bends and Cricket Square in the centre of the village. Metaphorically and literally, St. Matthias was the austere spiritual heart of the village. St. Arnold's may be prettier, may be more visited, more photographed, more elegiacally sung of than the simple prosody of St. Matthias, but the latter was bigger. It was greyer. It was older. It had seen centuries of moping owls complaining at moons, and many a woodpecker pockmarked the ancient yew in the churchyard. St. Matthias had seen the very tapestry of Christianity ravel and twist neath its Norman tower. It had seen Reformation, Counter-Reformation, and no small amount of nonconformity. The only slight stain upon its fabric was a bruising encounter with the arts and crafts movement. Such was the extent of their zeal that, to this day, the very name of Morris was anathema in the sacristy. They had, mercifully, spared the medieval glass, which on this pale winter's morn cast its green and pink light upon the rood screens and the tall, sturdy figure of Kingston Bagpuys, proud sexton of St. Matthias, and the hero of this particular vignette. Kingston Arlet Bagpuys, a name for the ages, venerated and beloved by all in Wesley Turpin. Well, all that followed the Turpin cricket team in any case, and that, well, that was the whole village, of course. Bagpuys had first come to the village before the first television as a journeyman professional from the glories of the Caribbean when the world was still black and white. He had sauntered casually to the cricket pavilion one dank May morning and, as the first rays of sun peeped through the clouds, offered to take a turn in the nets. With his gangly frame and pinwheeling limbs seemingly operating with gay independence from his torso, he had gambolled freely to the crease and, breasting the wicket, launched the leather-bound missile at Sunshine Jackson, the village's proud opener. Sunshine Jackson, in those days a ruddy youth of insouciant elegance, was, to be honest, more accustomed to the gentle parabolae of rotund and bleary village clerks turning their arms over than that of an imperious Jamaican. The tenor crackle of splintering willow was offset by the castrato shriek Jackson let out as the ball carooned off his bat and into the stumps. Well, that was that. Immediately Bagpuys was offered room and board at the Moon, and a purse of 5 shillings a week as the team's professional. And, oh, what a glorious season had followed. Records tumbled, teams came and went, tails firmly between their ample thighs, and the greying old men on the memorial bench swore loudly they'd never seen such a player. With lissom grace, Bagpuys bowled and batted his team to the victory pennant, the Empire Cup, the all-county plate, brushing aside all comers with cheery and violent disdain. Of such stuff, a legend's made. As with the boast of heraldry, the inevitable hour eventually came, and Kingston Mugpwees, now in his late 50s, hung up his boots and finally forswore the linseed oil, this to the eternal joy of cricketers young and old from the surrounding hamlets. His tall frame was now stooped with age, and having lived for many decades above the moon, was now paunched, portly and girt with dewlaps. He was offered and took, with his customary monosyllabic zeal, a voluntary role within the parish church. Not pay, nothing so vulgar was spoken, but the esteem with which he was held by the village ensured that the collection plate was always a tinkle with enough coin of the realm to ensure that Kingston Mugpwees had all the suet pudding and milk stout an elderly man could want for. His job was twofold. Firstly, he and the ineffable Melton Constable spent their Sabbath as the churchwardens of St. Matthias. With their staves proudly held erect, they would usher parishioners pewward, and then, when, as was custom, the rector went on a little too long with his usual perorations on the vile, lustful, sickening inevitability of bodily sin, they would use the tip, a brass roundel stamped with the image of St. Matthias and his drooping hops, to poke a dozing parishioner back into some form of alertness. His quotidian work centred on the churchyard, with its ancient yew and diseased elms. Though village folk did tend to go on a bit, they did, from time to time, have a habit of dying. Every villager, tithes paid or no, had an ancient and inalienable right to die, and also to be buried in one of England's most verdant churchyards, and it fell upon the broad shoulders of Kingston Mugpwees to excavate a hole for their eternal interment. He was well suited to the role, with his long, levering limbs proving ample to the needs of hole-mongery, whatever the weather, which frequently it was. He dwelt, as was ancient custom, during the day in a shed, hard-pressed to the church's flank and accessible through the vestry. Kingston Mugpwees would wend his way from the moon early every evening, come rain, hail, or shine, a simple rope around his corduroy trousers acting as a belt, a faded print shirt open to the navel, and a cap of homespun, once red, green, and gold, but now a muddy brown, upon the back of his head. He would take from a pocket of his pants a large florid handkerchief and tootle his nose as he passed under the lych gate, and, gaining the church porch, produce from the other pocket an enormous iron key with which he would open the door of St. Matthias. Inside it was all cool stone and bared beams of bright oak. Kingston felt the calm from the walls chill his skin as he made his way to the vestry, where an altogether different sense assailed him. Born out of centuries of men of certain ages robing and disrobing, and the endless gambolling of gay youth of Westley Turpin, and certain pungency had imprinted itself on the very walls that proved impossible to either ignore or whitewash away. Through the fog, Kingston would saunter to the very back, and there, unlocking a small side door, he would stoop to conquer his own little shack, wherein the tools of his trade were neatly arranged. There was an old transistor radio, a small camp stool, and an old iron stove on which a small coffee pot stood. It is to here that Kingston Mugpwees would repair at any opportunity, whereon he would set out his stool, brush the dirt from his hands, unfurl a copy of the Racing Post from his back pocket, and, having artfully blown his nose, would set about the form with a small chewed pencil. And in such a way did our hero ply his endless days. The snow, which had fallen heavily overnight, was pockmarked by the trefoil fouling of a nocturnal horde of verminous and herbivorous beasts that had made the churchyard their home, and thus it lay like despoiled ermine across the greensward. St. Matthias looked gormenghastly in its winter coating, frosted, harsh, and as austere as only grey stone rubbed against grey clouds in search of recognition from the supreme being could. The racing was good, though, and Kingston Bagpuis poured his concentration into the form at Cheltenham and licked the stub of his pencil. The snow had halted work for the day, and that selfsame snow which mattressed the Crocae had also smothered the various graves he had dug. The terminal decline of the Nepenthes sisters, having reached its nadir, had enforced a double shift the day before, and Kingston Bagpuis had casually cursed their selfishness with every jarring cut his spade had made in the iron earth. Now the vast hole for their terminal recline lay covered and unseen. A confluence of snow and the tarpaulin, idly blown over the hole, had rendered the cavity quite invisible. His brown study was interrupted. Kingston sat up on his stool and cocked an ear. From within the church came the sound of conversation and the unmistakable clatter of equipment, plasticized and professional. As befits a man of a certain age and girth, Kingston Bagpuis leapt like an oxygen-starved salmon from his stool and cautiously beetled back into the church. He essayed through the vestry door and peeped down the nave. He was taken aback to spy a camera crew establishing themselves hard by the great north wall, all booms and gaffers. Standing pensively by the lectern stood a man in a sheepskin coat. "Oh, hello, hello!" beamed the little man gaily and tripped noiselessly towards the sexton munching an apple. As George Eliot was all too keen to point out, an alderman about to be mayor must by and large enlarge his dinner parties, but at present there were plenty of guests at his well-spread table. Kingston Bagpuis was not running for mayor. His good friend the ineffable Melton Constable had that as good as sewn up, were there even such a role. But the point held. With his stool and his papers, his room above the hearth of the moon under water, and with it being national hunt season, he had all the guests at his table he could want. Men beaming at him within the walls of his custodial domain were unwanted, unwelcome, and unnecessary. The small man had breasted the nave and was now leaning conspiratorially against the altar.
"You see, my man, we're here to do a wee sport of filming hereabouts. The BBC," he added,
as though Kingston Bagpuis would take that as a fait accompli.
"We na need, sir," replied the taciturn giant. "Na need you coming here and stealing about like thieves in the night. What you want with filming in St. Matthias, anyway?" "What's a small feature?" the small man tittered nervously. "A magazine show, sport of lay relief. Majesty of the English Church, Thomas Gray, Hugh Scully, Frank Borff. I think Bechman meets Colbritannia," he glibly pattered.
"Your precious little need for poetry and pullovers here, sir. We make do with the hymnal and the sure and certain hope of salvation. You're born here, you're baptized, you're buried here, and no amount of television can stand in the way of the Lord."
Kingston Bagpuis pulled himself up to his full height, as though to emphasize the point, and wordlessly pointed towards the north door.
"Begone, back to Babylon," he said solemnly and irreproachably.
The small man shrugged his shoulders.
"Come on, Charlie, let's do one. I'll have to whip something out. It's not like there's a shortage of pastoral churchyards around here we can get a few shots of."
This last was accompanied by the dropping of the remains of the apple. He turned on his heel and walked off down the nave. Now, The nave of St. Matthias is some 22 yards long, as if laid out with immaculate precision by the celestial groundsman himself, in the certainty of all things. As the television producer reached the end of the church, he turned laconically, and was met by the full force of 5.5 ounces of Cox's orange pippin upside the head. He recoiled, stung. He yelped, as only a cowardly pale man in his late 40s can. Apple flesh clung to the sheepskin of his coat, and a small welt could be seen emerging on his cheek, a ruddy blush emphasizing his defeat. Kingston Bugpuss stood at a few steps away, the momentum from his short run-up having taken him into the church proper. He scowled as he bent down to pick up the remains of the fruit, and, having wiped away the warm, wet circle from the floor, turned smartly on his heel and walked back to his mark. A mere luster plot, he thought to himself, but I still got me righteous hard. And he smiled. The same shy smile laced with menace he had had when Sunshine Jackson had first looked back at his shattered stump some 30 years earlier.
From Here to Obscurity was written by Brian Painting, original music by Vincent Ridden, and featured the vocal talents of Charlie Benison. It is, was, and never shall be a very broad and very shallow production.